Welcome to Hub History, the show that brings you fascinating stories from Boston's history. This is episode 5, Secret Nazis on Boston Harbor. Hi, I'm Jake.
And I'm Nikki. And this week, we're going to step into some 20th century history. At the end of the Second World War, the U.S. military opened a secret program that located Nazi scientists and found ways to bring them into the United States before the Russians could find them. For many of these scientists, their first stop in the U.S. on their way to White Sands Missile Range or the Manhattan Project was right here in Boston.
And unlike many of our stories, where we do original research and bring you lots of primary sources, this week's episode is mostly based on one really amazing article. So right off the bat, we'd like to offer a big thanks to David Boeri at WBUR, and we'll have a link to his fantastic 2010 article in the show notes for this week's episode. But before we talk about Boston's secret Nazis, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is November 28th, and that's the anniversary of Boston's Coconut Grove fire in 1942. Coconut Grove was a popular nightclub in downtown Boston, and it was packed on the night of the fire. When the fire broke out, exits were blocked, and the fire moved quickly. 492 people were killed, making it the worst nightclub fire in history, and leading to tighter fire codes. We'll have a link to the Coconut Grove Coalition's website on the show notes for today's episode.
Leonard Hoar, that's H-O-A-R, died on November 29th, 1675. He was a minister in early Boston, and he was eventually elected as president of Harvard in 1672. However, he became known as a religious radical, out of step with the Puritan hierarchy, and was forced to resign a few months before his death.
Early winter in 1773 was a tense time in Boston, as resentment mounted against merchants who wanted to sell a consignment of tea. On November 30th, artist John Singleton Copley attempted to negotiate an agreement between the tea consignees and the radicalized citizens of Boston known as the Body of the People. The Boston Tea Party would occur less than 3 weeks later.
Thursday is December 1st, and a British officer in occupied Boston wrote to a friend on December 1st, 1775, confidently predicting that the revolution wouldn't survive the winter. Quote, "Many of our men are sick, and fresh provisions are very dear, but the rebels must be in much worse condition from their want of clothing and proper shelter. I hope one severe winter campaign, and indeed it promises to be a very severe one, will cool their enthusiasm."
Our wise Abigail Adams offered an opinion on the opiate of choice in her day on December 2nd, 1798, writing, "Laudanum, I do not like it. I had rather suffer for want of rest than go into the habit of taking it."
White Bostonians rioted on December 3rd, 1860, to prevent abolitionist Frederick Douglass from taking the stage at Tremont Temple. He was attempting to deliver an address commemorating the anniversary of John Brown's death, but police intervened and shut the meeting down.
Finally, Sunday is December 4th, and that's the date in 1849 when Senator Charles Sumner argued a case before the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, arguing that Boston schools should be desegregated. Though the case was unsuccessful, Boston schools were nominally desegregated in 1855. However, racial segregation in schools has remained a tense issue throughout the busing crisis of the 1970s, and really right to the present day. We'll have a link to Sumner's argument in today's show notes.
This week, we're stepping into a little-known chapter of Boston's 20th century history, but the story starts in war-torn Europe.
The Allies were stunned by the technological and scientific advances made by Hitler's Germany. Everything from jet airplanes to stealth technology to nuclear weapons made huge advances under the Reich. Some of the most terrifying inventions of the war years were the V-1 and V-2 missiles. The V-1 buzz bomb was an early cruise missile, while the V-2 was a ballistic missile. It could be launched from Germany into space before crashing into London to explode. The V-2 was the forefather of both the space program and the Cold War, and the father of the V-2 was a scientist named Wernher von Braun.
Von Braun was the wunderkind of German rocketry. He'd been obsessed with the possibility of spaceflight since he was a teen, and he got his doctorate by the age of 22. By the time he was 25 years old, he was a member of the Nazi Party and successfully launching liquid-fueled rockets.
His enthusiasm for space came with a seeming disregard for the people killed by his rockets and missiles, inspiring the Tom Lehrer lyrics,
"Once the rockets are up, who cares where they come down? That's not my department," says Werner von Braun.
In the spring of 1945, the Soviet Red Army had pushed within 100 miles of von Braun's base in Germany. With the Nazi regime rapidly collapsing around him, he began to look for a suitable end to his war. And while the fighting was ongoing, U.S. and Russian teams were racing around Germany, attempting to capture technological resources and valuable personnel. Like many Germans, von Braun thought he'd be treated more leniently by the Americans, so he needed to find his way to American lines.
And one account says that he used falsified papers to steal a train.
No matter how he did it, about 500 members of his team made it from the Baltic Sea coast in the extreme northeast of today's Germany to the Bavarian Alps. There, SS officers had orders to kill any scientists who might be captured by the enemy in order to safeguard their secrets. Nonetheless, the team slipped across the border into Austria and into American hands.
Having evaded the SS and the Soviets, and having been approved by the U.S. military, von Braun was moved around Germany and interrogated at secret bases. Then, he was handed over to a secret army unit called Operation Paperclip to be taken into the U.S. And like many top Nazi scientists, his entry point was right here in Boston. To understand why Boston was an attractive option for the military intelligence operatives who brought these German scientists into the U.S., we have to step back in time. Before the Second World War, before the Great War, and even before the Civil War. During the heyday of naval power, it was important for a port city like Boston to be protected by a network of forts. So starting in the 1830s, a ring of three stone forts was built in the Boston Harbor Islands.
Fort Warren on George's Island is probably the best preserved, and it can be visited by ferry in the summer months.
A few decades later, modern concrete forts were added on several more harbor islands. These were cutting edge during the World War I era, but their importance was dwindling by the beginning of World War II.
In the age of aircraft carriers and submarines, shore-based artillery was just less of an effective deterrent.
Most of the forts still had at least some military presence. Some were used as bases for submarine nets or spotters, while Fort Andrews on Peddix Island was used to house prisoners of war. So when it comes time to bring these captured scientists into the States, Boston has large Army and Navy bases, a modern port, air bases like the one at Squantum Point, as well as this network of isolated harbor islands under military control.
German scientists could come in by air or by sea, but in either case, the last leg was by Boston Whaler across the harbor.
And this is an area where David Boyeri's article is priceless. He was able to interview one of the Army intelligence officers involved in Project Paperclip in the brief window between the project being declassified and the officer's death in 2010.
In 1945, Henry Kolm was a 21-year-old Austrian Jewish immigrant who had been on the last refugee ship to make it out of Europe in 1939, and many of his close friends and relatives died in the camps. Kolm had recently joined the U.S. Army, and because he was fluent in German, one of his first assignments was interrogating Nazi POWs. But at the end of the war, he had a different assignment. When troop ships would come into Boston Harbor bearing one of the project's Nazi scientists, Kolm's team would rendezvous with the ship in the outer harbor before harbor pilots met the vessel. In the dead of night, often in heaving seas, the crew would lower the scientist off the deck of a towering ship to the small boat far below, in the lee of Nix's mate.
When the German scientists came ashore at Long Island's Fort Strong, they found a world that might have reminded them of their universities or labs back in Germany. An old hotel on Long Island had been converted into a luxurious barracks for them, and it was staffed by their fellow countrymen. To help keep the island secret, military intelligence had combed through POW camps around New England and pulled out prisoners to serve as cooks, bakers, tailors, and stewards.
No need to worry about chatty civilians if your whole hotel staff is made up of prisoners.
Exactly. And within this gilded cage, the engineers and scientists created a scholarly atmosphere. Holding lectures and exchanging ideas, it became comfortable enough that the island was jokingly referred to as the House of German Science.
That's Haus der Deutschen Wissenschaft.
While the scientists enjoyed Boston's hospitality, Henry Kolm and his colleagues were busy assigning them to post-war projects and cleaning up their war records to make them more appealing to America.
Depending on their areas of expertise, the scientists and engineers from Fort Strong ended up at military bases and defense contractors all over the country. Many engineers and physicists went to Oak Ridge National Laboratory or Los Alamos to work on the Manhattan Project. Rocket scientists were sent to Aberdeen Proving Grounds in Maryland or White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico. Von Braun himself ended up at Fort Bliss in Texas. The U.S. Army falsified documents to hide his background, and he was granted a security clearance to work on highly classified projects.
Because a former Nazi obviously wouldn't be granted security clearance otherwise, so this is an incident where we see, you know, this secret unit in the Army really pulling the wool over the eyes of the rest of the Army and the entire defense industry and really America at large.
Eventually, Von Braun would become a familiar figure to Americans. He was a very public and enthusiastic spokesperson for the space program, appearing in newspapers and popular magazines, as well as eventually on television through a partnership with Walt Disney. He advised Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, as well as NASA and the Apollo astronauts. However, he remains an incredibly controversial figure. Because the Army had whitewashed his background, many Americans didn't realize his deep ties to the Nazi regime until much later. Von Braun would explain this away as a politically expedient way to keep working on his beloved rockets, but he not only joined the Nazi Party, he joined the SS. He eventually reached the rank of Sturmbannführer, and he was knighted by Hitler himself.
And not only that, his V-2 rocket factory had used slave labor from the concentration camps, so he really couldn't claim ignorance.
Again, he tried to minimize his involvement, saying at times that he wasn't aware of the worst aspects or that he felt powerless to stop it. However, other witnesses say that he personally picked laborers from the camps and that at times he had ordered prisoners to be whipped. A survivor of the camp said, quote, "On a little area beside the clinic shack, you could see piles of prisoners every day who had not survived the workload and had been tortured to death by the vindictive guards. But Professor Werner von Braun just walked past them, so close that he almost touched the bodies." That satirical song written by Tom Lehrer in 1965 mocked von Braun's claims to be an apolitical scientist, calling America's attention to his complicity in the Nazi regime.
"A man whose allegiance is ruled by expedience, call him a Nazi, he won't even frown. Nazi schmatzi," says Werner von Braun.
Von Braun retired from NASA in 1972 and died in 1977, having realized his dream of putting men on the moon.
Fort Strong was decommissioned after the war, and the island passed back into civilian use. However, that doesn't mean it has been open to the public. Long Island was used for social services both before and after the war years. The city almshouse was moved to the island in the 1880s, followed by hospitals and other city institutions. In the 1950s, a bridge and causeway were built that connected Long Island to the mainland. More and more public and nonprofit social service agencies moved to Long Island over the years, until it became the city's main site for homeless shelters and substance abuse treatment by the 1980s. In many ways, it was the perfect location for these agencies, as there were no neighbors to be annoyed or frightened. And, unfortunately, the bridge was condemned in 2014, and the island was abruptly evacuated. Today, the bridge has been demolished, the island is abandoned, and it's still closed to the public.
But I've been there. I was excited to learn recently that I'm one of a very few members of the public to have visited Boston's Long Island. When Op Sail brought a festival of tall ships to Boston Harbor in 1980, the island was briefly opened to residents of Quincy so they could watch the ships come in. I was about 18 months old at the time, and my mother put me in the basket on her bicycle, and we rode across the causeway and bridge to watch the ships come in. I feel like I'm part of a special group.
So, wrapping it up, guess what we have this week?
What's that?
Listener feedback. Tour guide Ben Edwards tweeted us after our first episode and said, "Jake and Nikki, great job on the first Hub History podcast. Really enjoyed it." And David Allen Lampert also said, "Hats off to the team at Hub History for a great kickoff." And Patrice wrote in to say, love it. I am studying the American Revolution, and we had a conversation at the dinner table tonight about Pope's Day and Guy Fawkes. What a coincidence. Thanks so much. Thank you very much.
A couple of people offered additional selections to read after our second episode on smallpox in early Boston. Lori Waller said, love the story. Zabediel Boylston and Lady Mary Wortley Montagu first braved the naysayers. And she recommended the book The Speckled Monster by Jennifer Lee Carell.
The Massachusetts Historical Society responded to recommend an article on the Boston smallpox epidemic by Amelie Koss in the Massachusetts Historical Review. And we'll have links to both in the show notes for this week's episode.
Finally, we had a couple of people compare us to the Bowery Boys, a podcast on New York history that I'd never heard of until people wrote into us. Matt Robert said, I'm so glad you're doing this podcast. I discovered the Bowery Boys recently and was hoping there was a Boston one. And President John Adams, who tweets as Second POTUS, said, yo, if you like Boston history, you need to listen to Jake from Hub History. NYC history, check out Bowery Boys. All right, where can people find out more about Operation Paperclip and the secret Nazi scientists in Boston Harbor?
Of course, we'll have a link to David Boeri's article, World War II Era Pictures of Fort Strong, and a YouTube video of Tom Lehrer's satirical song about Wernher von Braun in the show notes for this week's episode at hubhistory.com/005.
If you want to get in touch with us, we're on Facebook at facebook.com/hubhistory, and our Twitter handle is @hubhistory. You can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com or go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're there, be sure to click on subscribe to see all the ways to subscribe to the show. If you subscribe on iTunes, please consider reviewing us there. Your reviews will help other listeners find the show.
That's all for now, and we'll be back next time with a show about the 1689 Boston Revolt.